Back when Americans were listening to Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles, China's airwaves were full of songs with lyrics from Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. Things have loosened up a bit since then, but China's government still bans music that mentions sex, violence, or has low-class humor. That rules out a good chunk of the Ryan Seacrest Top 40. Turn on the radio in China today, and you're most likely to hear something like this. Yeah. Well, now the internet has given Chinese music fans free access to pretty much everything. As part of our series on the effect of the internet on Chinese arts and culture, NPR's Laura Seidel has this profile of an independent musician using the internet to make a name for himself.
B6 is eating a slice of pizza when he opens the door of his apartment.
Hi, I'm Laura. Nice to meet you.
The 27-year-old electronic musician lives and works in a high-rise on the outskirts of the city. We sit down in his studio, and he explains it was the internet that really allowed him to explore his passion for electronic music.
While I was in high school, I used to listen to rock and roll music. It was very hard to get foreign or Western music. You had to go to the black market to get CDs.
But when B6 got access to the internet in 1999, it opened up a whole new world.
We used those peer-to-peer websites like Napster to download music.
B6 fell in love with electronic music such as techno and intelligent dance music out of Detroit, Michigan. Now his own compositions range from dance music to the contemplative. This is a piece he calls My Post-Rock Yard. It's about the small and somewhat disheveled garden outside the window of his studio.
People misunderstand electronic music. Electronic music does not necessarily have to be cold. It can be very human, and even warmer than acoustic music.
Not only is the internet helping B6 find new music, it's helping him make a living from his work. Until recently, musicians who weren't officially sanctioned by the government couldn't sell CDs or get airplay. But now the market has opened up.
Sometimes I sell some of my own CDs, and sometimes I help do soundtracks for commercials and movies. And sometimes I do soundtracks for installation art at galleries.
B6 knows it's rare to be able to make a living from your music in China, and he wants to help other independent musicians support themselves. So a couple of years ago, he became one of the founders of a website called Neocha. He and co-founder Sean Liao wanted to figure out a way for independent musicians to make money. But Liao says they didn't know what it was.
Necessity is the mother of invention, in that Chinese musicians and Chinese labels and everybody that's in this industry is getting pushed so hard and trying to figure this model out that maybe they'll come on a solution before someone in the U.S. does.
Neocha sells advertising and they split the revenue with the artists. They don't even bother trying to sell the music because there's so much piracy in China, there is no point. One way Neocha promotes the music is with an online music player called Next. Turn it on and you can listen to a random sampling of songs by Neocha musicians. Don't like that? Click the button that says Next and you get something else. Sean Liao says that what independent musicians in China need is a way to make a living with their music.
It's kind of a cyclical thing that we need to help them just get to a level where they can start making some money so that they can live out and achieve their creative potential.
The internet isn't just a way to help musicians make money, it's also a way for them to connect with each other. It's a Thursday night, and B6 is hopping on a packed train with three musicians from Japan. They're all heading to play a club in Nanjing, a gig they planned together online.
We have the internet, like MSN live message, so we can, get connected with all the musicians from all over the world.
2.5 hours later, they arrive in Nanjing and head to a smoky basement club called Castle Bar. It's packed with trendy-looking young Chinese and Westerners. It's a pastiche of brightly colored hair, cargo pants, blue jeans, and short skirts. B6 stands behind a glass window in the DJ booth. His MacBook is hooked into the sound system. The crowd looks on and then starts to move out to the dance floor. The club doesn't empty out until after 3 a.m. A couple of fans stop to talk with me, Johnny Ju and Yao Lian. They give the same answer when I ask them how they first heard electronic music.
On website.
Internet.
B6 has his criticisms of the way the Communist Party still manages the media in his country, but he feels optimistic about the future. He says the government is trying to encourage creativity.
I know that in the minds of many foreigners, China is the world's factory. That is not the image the Chinese government would like to project to the world.
B6 says the government wants the Chinese people to be more creative, so he believes there will be more openings for independent artists like himself, especially as more young people explore what's on the internet. Here's a song by B6 about what he thinks the world will be like in 50 years. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Coming up tomorrow, Chinese novelists putting their writing online. They're applying new technology to an old Chinese tradition of underground writing. Back in the time of Mao, writers had to pass around notebooks with their handwritten novels.
It was very dangerous to copy them and to pass them around. You could get in trouble if you got caught with them.
Now, internet novelists get their readers to pay by the chapter, and some of them are breaking into traditional publishing. While Democrats and Republicans work together toward a bipartisan solution on the mortgage crisis, there's a very partisan battle on the campaign trail. This campaign began with predictions that activist groups would play an influential role. And so far, no group has had quite the impact that Swift Boat Veterans for Truth did when they attacked Democrat John Kerry's war record 4 years ago. But nonprofits are quietly mobilizing, especially on the left. NPR's Peter Overby looked into one network of progressive groups.
Progress Now and its 8 affiliates aren't the only network of activist groups on the liberal side, but they offer a new way of trying to shape the debate with a combination of small staffs, low budgets, and high tech. Progress Now has been working in Colorado for 5 years. Listen as its director, Michael Huttner, describes how they take advantage of old media and new technology to gin up interest for an issue.
We'll put out a press release for the mainstream media, and then literally hours later we'll send out an email on the same topic to tens of thousands of people. The press actually get those emails sent to them, and then the press decides to write a story. And then when people read the story, then they go to the website and even take further action.
Officially, the progress groups aren't political organizations. They operate as nonprofits under Section 501c of the tax code. That means they have to talk in terms of issues, not candidates. Still, there's no mistaking where their hearts lie. Progress Now has a webpage called John McBush 2008, linking Republican candidate John McCain to the policies of President Bush. And the Alliance for a Better Minnesota bought TV time for this ad attacking Republican Senator Norm Coleman.
Coleman voted to give oil and gas companies billions of dollars in tax breaks. Maybe that's why oil and gas interests have given Coleman hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions.
But TV is expensive, and the progress groups don't consider TV ads their main mission anyway. Again, Progress Now's Michael Huttner.
The big hole in the progressive infrastructure that we filled was that in each state, we act almost like a PR firm to help all the different progressive organizations.
The left has never had anything like this, a place in cyberspace for groups to coordinate and deliver their messages to activists. There's nothing like it on the right. The expansion from Progress Now in Colorado to embrace 8 groups in various states began in 2006. Initial financing came from a coalition of big-dollar donors called the Democracy Alliance, which wants to build a long-lasting progressive infrastructure. Progress Ohio director Brian Rothenberg says the high-tech, low-cost approach seems to work.
You know, we're in an instant news kind of world now where you walk downtown, even in Midwestern cities like Columbus, and there are streaming things on the side of buildings that give you news.
But in digital world, Rothenberg says it's hard to know how well any new strategy works. For instance, he says Progress Ohio signed up 150 new activists per day.
You see exactly who comes to your site. You see exactly how many people click on your issue. You see exactly how many people open an email. So in that respect, it is very measurable. In the respect of, is 150 people a day good? I don't know.
Michael Kornfeld doesn't know either, and he studies online politics as a professor at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. He says it's hard to measure the effects because almost anyone can send out emails.
The sticking point is that because of the low costs, you have many more organizations competing for people's attention, and there's little evidence yet that the percentage of voters who are also activists has increased.
But there's also little evidence, according to Huttner, that the progress groups are suffering financially, even though Democratic candidate Barack Obama told his donors just last month not to give money to independent groups. Apparently, they're finding ways to reach donors just fine on their own. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
The Center for Investigative Reporting helped to report this piece.
Here on NPR, I've been talking about the joys and the travails of email this week, but there are plenty of other technologies that connect us. Text messaging, instant messaging, Skype, Facebook, MySpace, Twitter. The list keeps growing. NPR's Laura Seidel has a look at how people are navigating the wide array of choices.
Lenny Shaver has to be connected for work.
Hi, Lenny.
Hi.
Hi. Laura. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Shaver is 35 years old. He does marketing for a Silicon Valley tech firm. As we sit down in Shaver's home office, I see he's got several IM chats going. Shaver also text messages and uses Skype's internet phone service.
The funny thing is sometimes you have all three going simultaneously, which means you can have multiple layers of conversation. Like you could be in a teleconference with a business or client, and then you can, in the background, be sending text messages to your colleagues who are also on the phone call, but maybe not in the room with you. They're in a different country or a different state.
Shaver says all the different forms of communication have their uses. Email is for official communications that need to be documented. IM often replaces a quick phone call. Text messaging isn't for everyone.
At least for me, it's going right to someone's cell phone. It's still a little bit more personal. I don't send text messages to the CEO, but I'll send an email.
In the 45 minutes I was in Shaver's house, I saw him use 6 different types of communication.
If you look at the psychology textbooks, they basically say that what we see happening can't happen.
That's Clifford Nass, professor of communications at Stanford University. This may not surprise you, but at one time, psychologists thought it was impossible for people to have 2 intelligent conversations at once.
There's a problem called interference, which is if you, for example, hear 2 conversations at once, your brain is likely to mix the 2 together, leading to confusion. And the more communications, the more conversations, the more chaotic the communication would be.
Nass says he and other social scientists suspect that many of us are walking around a little mixed up, but it may be different for people who adapt to it versus those who are growing up with it.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
When I enter 16-year-old Sonia Javits's room on a weekday evening, her back is to the door. She's happily hunched over her MacBook, finishing an IM. She has several up on the screen.
Give or take, depending on which friends of mine are online, I can talk to, I'll usually talk up to like six people.
Javits does use email, but not very often. She likes IM. She leaves messages for people on Facebook. She even talks to people the old-fashioned way, on the phone. And she really likes to text message.
Texting is really quick, and if you just have a question or you don't really have that much time, you can just text them real fast. Or if you just don't want to talk on the phone, it's just a quick and easy way to just say, hey, I guess. So that's my phone vibrating.
Whoop. Wait a minute. She's got a text message. Her mother, Margaret Cicchetti, has adjusted to the way Sonia and her brother communicate.
Well, I've actually started texting the kids because when I used to leave voicemail messages, they wouldn't get them. And it was either because they didn't check their voicemail or they didn't notice. And it's much more efficient because they actually look at it right away.
16-year-old Sonia Javits says she can get overwhelmed.
I mean, there are thousands of ways online right now to do it. There are tons of things popping up, and it's really just a decision you have to make as an individual of how you want to communicate with your friends.
But here's the thing. Professor Nass says that historically, whenever a new communication tool is invented, the old ones don't go away. It just adds more alternatives. So we still use the mail, the telephone, FedEx, fax. Maybe a little less, but we still use them. Nass says, don't expect the choices to get easier. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Once you may have learned how to navigate new communication technologies, there's a new problem. How do you actually communicate? Should you feel free to be able to ignore unsolicited invitations to play online Scrabble or compare movies with someone you've never met? In fact, can you be friends with someone you've never met? On the other hand, how do you ignore their requests? Steve Johnson, internet critic for the Chicago Tribune, joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you so much, Steve.
It's a pleasure, Scott.
And this is awkward. Not a day goes by I don't get asked to be somebody's Facebook buddy. And typically they're strangers.
Yeah, especially if you're in sort of the public eye, you get a lot of people kind of, you know, looking around and trying to cozy up to you. It's a tough thing to figure out how to handle.
What's the etiquette?
Well, it's evolving. You know, this is a brand new world, and especially for those of us who are sort of out of the original Facebook demographic, shall we say, as Facebook expands and we all.
What do you mean us?
I haven't seen.
Go ahead. Yes.
I haven't seen your birth certificate, so I can't say that. I'm making assumptions here.
Hey, well, let's just say it's printed on parchment.
There we
go.
Go
ahead. Yeah.
A scroll. It's a scroll. So this stuff is fraught. To me, the term friend means something pretty specific, and yet you go on Facebook and business acquaintances are asking you to be a friend, or somebody you knew in high school but haven't talked to since, and you sort of have to muddle your way along, and I kind of guess at it.
Now, is somebody offended if you don't friend them?
People can be. As we get further into this, it's starting to work itself out a little bit. You can send a nice note saying, you know, I keep my friends to close friends and business acquaintances. Or I know people who have a different standard. A colleague of mine says, I'm tired of dealing with it. I'm just going to friend everybody. And I suppose that gives you an out. If one of your friends later turns out to be Ted Kaczynski, you can say, well, you know, I'm not discriminating here, so it's not my fault.
Yeah, but what if Ted Kaczynski sends you an email asking to play chess with you?
This is another problem. You get another etiquette issue beyond the friend thing is you get all these applications sent your way. You know, do you have to accept good karma from this friend? Is it rude to ignore good karma? Is it rude to point out that it's kind of silly passing digital good karma around? It's a quandary.
Karma is a nonsense enough phrase. When you add digital good karma to it, this really makes it hard to get through, Steve.
Well, have you received these sort of digital margaritas and cups of coffee that are passed around as gifts? And
yes.
People apparently actually pay a dollar to send around?
Yes, of course.
You sort of, you know, on the one hand, you're like, well, thanks, that's a nice gesture. And then on the other hand, you're like, you know, I used to think you had better sense than to spend a dollar on something like that.
Now, my children are quite young, but when the time comes, can you really be Facebook friends with your children?
Yeah, that's a huge issue. Do you really want to get into that part of your son or daughter's life? You know, when you become friends, the Facebook world that they have created kind of opens up to you, and that's a real issue. Same thing with your boss. I think with your boss, the rule is if your boss asks you to be friends, you'd better say yes, but you probably don't go out of your way to friend your boss.
Do you have anything that we'll chance to call rules that people ought to observe if they're approached to be somebody's friend?
Boy, as in most things, the golden rule really applies. It's amazing how well it endures. If someone tries to friend you and you don't want to be friends, don't be a jerk about it. Be polite and decline politely. Don't go out of your way to collect friends. Just basically do unto others, even in the digital world.
Well, Steve, poke you later.
Please. Please don't. Hey, one virtual margarita coming your way.
Virtual latte right back at you.
Oh, awesome.
Steve Johnson, internet critic for the Chicago Tribune.
Thanks.
If you're like a lot of people, the first thing you'll do when you get to work today is check your email. And consider how many times this sound will interrupt something that you're working on today. If you heard that sound and involuntarily turned toward the computer, imagine going the whole day without reading or sending a single email. That's what employees at a Chicago-based wireless communications company do every Friday. They'll do it today, as NPR's David Schaefer has the next part of our week-long series on email.
You know those annual employee satisfaction surveys when the bosses ask what can they do to make your work life better? U.S. Cellular does that. And about 3 years ago, employees told Vice President and Chief Operating Officer Jay Ellison they were getting too many emails. Ellison responded by banning emails on Fridays.
I got a lot of pushback from a lot of people that I was nuts. They have to operate that way, and I pushed right back on them. I respect that, you know, pushback, but I heard the associates, we're going to try this.
Ellison says the company tried it for 2.5 months, and everyone loved it, even those who first didn't like the idea.
I think people would outright, you know, just freak out if we started emails back up on Friday. I know the frontline leadership would scream. I'd have a mutiny on my hands.
The policy is a little bit loose. Nobody gets fired for sending emails on Fridays. And for urgent matters, if email is the best way to communicate something, by all means, employees can send them. And they don't find their inboxes overstuffed on Monday mornings. But Jay Ellison says the idea is for people to talk to one another, converse, and collaborate more. And along the way, some staffers, like Executive John Coyle, make some amazing discoveries. Coyle says one Friday he was about to send an email to a colleague in finance whom he had never met, but he called him instead.
He goes, "Hey, I see from the extension you're in Madison." I'm like, "Well, yeah, but you're in Chicago, right?" He goes, "No, I'm in Madison too." I'm like, "Oh, really? Where?" And he said, "On the fourth floor." And I said, "I'm on the fourth floor." I said, "Where do you sit?" And he said, "In the southwest corner." And I'm like, "I'm on the south side of the building. So that means you're about 50 feet from me." And I literally got up, I walked around the corner, and there he was. I had no idea.
I'm walking around the cubicles of U.S. Cellular Chicago headquarters, seeing if I can catch anyone sneaking a peek in their inbox or sending some funny chain emails. But it's not happening here. What's happening is that people here like to be released from their email jails once a week. They're actually spending more time walking around talking face-to-face.
Hi.
And I see that you guys are kind of congregating here. Is that because you would normally be sending emails to have this conversation, but you're talking to each other face-to-face?
We just seem to chat a lot.
Cheryl Handley works in customer strategy and marketing.
Well, maybe that's a function of the Friday no emails, but I think we do enjoy just getting together and talking a lot more.
Handley's colleague, Robin Stitcher, says discussing ideas and problems face-to-face is much more productive.
We've been talking here for about 15 minutes, and it's been really good. We're talking about ideas, brainstorming, so definitely more effective than, you know, shooting emails back and forth to each other.
And you are?
I'm Steve DeCaspers. I'm also in the customer strategy and planning team. Mm-hmm. I've actually gone so far as to implement my own no email Wednesdays and Thursdays as well. So I'm not in communication with anybody during the last half of the week.
He's joking, of course, and U.S. Cellular employees say email does have its critical place in their work. They are, after all, in the business of selling us on wireless communications, including email. Just don't email them about that on a Friday. David Schaefer, NPR News, Chicago.
The co-author of A Guide to Email says his workplace has not adopted email-free Fridays, and that seems fine with him. David Shipley is op-ed editor for the New York Times. His book is called Send.
Email-free Fridays are positive in that they are sort of the first cry for help from citizenry drowning by email. They aren't such a good thing in that it's basically an avoidance strategy. why don't we have Fridays where we learn to email a little bit better? Or we are going to spend Fridays emailing only between the hours of 9 and 5. And, you know, email is an absolutely fantastic communication tool. And it's incumbent on us to do it better, not just avoid it and give up.
Okay, so you said don't answer emails except between 9 and 5. That would be one way to do it, I suppose.
Well, a huge strategy is don't send them between 9 and 5. And I was, you know, we were talking earlier about my walk over from the New York Times building to the NPR studios. And on the way, I was just sort of conducting an informal survey. And I saw 8, maybe 9 people just blackberrying away.
Can I just mention, you're walking through Midtown Manhattan near Times Square, one of the most spectacular and interesting places to look around, and you're looking at people who aren't looking around.
Exactly. And how many of us have actually pulled out our BlackBerries and just sent off a bunch of emails to fill those interstitial spaces? Now, you know, it's a fine way to occupy your time, but you have to ask, well, what's going to happen to the person who has received all those emails?
Well, let me ask if it might be advisable for many people to question whether they should have a BlackBerry or the equivalent device.
Do you have a BlackBerry, Steve?
I'm afraid I do.
And so what are your general habits?
Well, just lately I've tried to avoid using it at all outside of work. I've realized that my day seems to get a lot longer and more relaxed and slower paced if I don't use it once I leave work.
I mean, one really helpful way to think about BlackBerries is the crossword puzzle rule. If you were in a certain social setting, would you do a crossword puzzle in it? If we're in a meeting, would you pull out a crossword and start filling away? And I think if you replace crossword with BlackBerry, you'll find you're using it in places where you really shouldn't be using it. Now, there are things that the world can do to help. I mean, Google, as you probably know, introduced this funny feature recently. It's called the Email Addict. When you click the icon on Google, it says, take a walk, get some real work done, or have a snack. We'll be back in 15 minutes or 14 minutes or whatever it says. And then your screen goes gray. And, of course, you can open it up again, but it makes you think. It cultivates a certain mindfulness that says, okay, should I be sending these emails right now? Maybe I should pick up the phone, or maybe I should talk to a family member. You know, there's a wonderful quote from Bob Geldof, who should be known for humanitarian things and great music. Email gives the illusion of progress even when nothing is happening. Hmm. And I think we're finding that more and more in our lives, that we spend our entire days emailing, and we leave the office with sort of this email haze at the end of the day. And we think, you know, I was incredibly busy today. I fired off all these emails, but what actually happened? You know, we're emailing more and we're communicating less.
David Shipley is co-author of Send, The Essential Guide to Email for Office and Home. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for speaking with me.
And our series continues tomorrow morning on Weekend Edition Saturday. NPR's Laura Seidel is going to ask if we have too many ways to connect. If you have an opinion about that, of course, you can grab the BlackBerry, send somebody a text message, post your view on Facebook or Twitter.